What else?
I've got some questions here from Dave Arishigas. Yeah, his first question is, in chapter 45 of Krishna book, Srila Prabhupada lists the arts and sciences required in human society that Krishna and Balaram learned from Sannipanimuni. Among them is the line, they learned how to train and engage rams and cocks in fighting for sport. He wants to know how we should understand and explain this to someone who sees this in the same category as blood sports.
As what?
Well, he's with Kirit.
As what kind of sports?
Cruel blood sports.
Not cruel, because they wouldn't let the animals kill each other. But they just fight there. You read Krishna book. Another thing, they're always goading bulls to fight each other and stuff like that. That's part of Vrindavan Leela. But it's in fun. They do it to a certain extent. First of all, if anybody opens their mouth about something like that, ask them if they're meat eaters. If they're meat eaters, then tell them to shut their mouths and tell them I have nothing to say to them. If they're complete vegetarians, then they don't even bother to answer the question. Otherwise, they don't even deserve an answer to their question. If we're talking about blood sports. Their whole life is based on blood, so what's the problem even if it was a blood sport that happens once in a while? And people like that have no right to say anything. But that's not the way it was, and it's like that. Small bulls, big bulls, they used to encourage them to, fight, push head to head, but that's to the same extent that men wrestle. So people can wrestle, and you can wrestle for fun, or you can wrestle for blood. All wrestling doesn't mean that it's blood. So similarly, engaging animals to fight, that's also has its limits. So all fighting doesn't mean it's a blood sport. But do they eat meat? That's the main question. Go ahead. What's the other one?
They've asked you, Smith Kirit. Do you want to ask your question, Dave Rishi? Okay, I'll ask the second question. In the Shakshi Gopal pastime, CC Medulina 520, the elderly Brahmin promises to give his daughter in charity to the young Brahmin. We are obviously used to a father giving his daughter away when she marries, but please ask how to explain this concept of giving a daughter in charity. In 5:29, the Brahmin specifically says, my daughter is my own property. If I chose to give my property to someone, who has the power to stop me?
So the question is about giving your daughter away in charity?
Yeah. If Devrishi, you're with Kirit, right? You can ask if... Oh, his mic's not working, so...
Well, don't you think it's nicer for a father to give away his daughter to a suitable... to ensure that he's giving away his daughter to a suitable man instead of just letting her out loose on the street to be prostituted and jumped upon by any man who comes along just because she thinks that she's in love? You mean it's better just to set him loose amongst the wolves than to actually take care of them and then give them to a suitable husband?
Pretty much. He's saying that the question is more about her being his property.
Yeah, his property in the sense that he's responsible for her. He's responsible. He's taken care of her up to now. And it's his duty to actually ensure that he's going to actually give it to a suitable person. And if he finds a suitable person, then why should someone else have anything to say about it? They hadn't had anything to say about it up to now. Whatever it is, 15, 20 years, no one's had anything to say about all the time, energy, money, and everything else that you put into raising a person. Then why at a certain point when it comes to being married that he shouldn't have something to say about it? Not his property, then in the thing that he says is his, because he's a Brahmin, he's a Vaishnav, so he doesn't think that anything's his anyway. And it's just a term of address. It's his, it means that she's his responsibility. How can anyone else have anything to say about it? Follow?
Yes, I'll just read out his...
Because the principle is that women are not independent. So they're not their own property. So they have to be, someone else has to be responsible for them. In other words, they're not meant to be responsible for themselves. The father's meant to be responsible, or the husband's meant to be responsible for them. So that's what that's meant to represent. And then? Hello? Hello?
That sounds good to make a question.
Okay, but I can't hear you.
Yeah, that sounds good to make a question.
Okay.
Yeah, wait. Okay, Ramani Brenda has a question.
So much further to that, though, then she's saying that she's different to property because she has her own feelings and wishes.
So?
So, I guess what I suspect he's trying to say is that property, you know, when you refer to something as property, so it kind of negates the fact that they have any feelings or wishes.
Well, not really, but it's a different culture. In other words, parents don't take, or at least they have a right not to take into consideration children's desires and wishes. That's why they're parents. They may or they may not. It depends on the circumstance and the situation. When children want to play until midnight alone in the street at night, then parents say, tough luck, I don't care about your desires and wishes. When they want to just, you know, eat chocolate all day long, or they just want to eat chocolate-coated rice and nothing else, then parents have to step in and say, sorry, you're going to eat this other thing. And it doesn't matter what your likes and wishes are, because that's what a child is. A child is both immature and inexperienced, whereas parents are mature and experienced. And children aren't supposed to be guinea pigs, but they're meant to actually be given proper direction. Especially children shouldn't be experimenting with themselves. But in Vedic culture, it's very much when, you know, girls are asked, just like the Swayambara, they choose their own husband. That's a type of choice. That's a type of marriage. When there's the scope for that, when the person's mature and old enough, then fine. If something's really very much ideal, and the father and mother find someone who's very ideal, then generally the idea is that the girl goes along with that because she has faith in them. Because how does she know? She's never even looked at a man. She's never even talked to one. So on what basis is she going to determine what her likes and wishes are? When you live in a society where, you know, every girl sleeps with 20 men before they get married, if they ever get married, then that's a different story. But otherwise, when, you know, girls don't even talk to men, what to speak of, you know, going out and what to speak of having intimate contact with them, then how will they know what their likes and dislikes are? There may be, and therefore there's that type of, there are those types of arrangements, just like, you know, when Devahuti heard from Narada Muni about Kardama Muni, she never saw him, but on the basis of what she heard about his character, she fell in love with him. So then her father went to the other side of the world just to try and convince this boy to marry her, because he took it into consideration. So it's not that it's not ignored, but it was on the basis of some solid groundwork. It wasn't that he sent Devahuti out, okay, well, why don't you just go out there yourself and, you know, come back and let me know what you think. That's not what he did. Same thing. When Rukmini heard about Krishna, then she wanted to marry Krishna just by hearing about him. Her father wanted that, but except her brother was the one who wanted him to marry Shishupala, not Shishupala. Who? Someone that Shishupala, yeah. So, you know, it's not that it's not there, but it should be reasonable. It's not just, you know, blind, yeah, let anyone just think anything and feel anything and just figure it out for themselves. You just throw them out there on their own. It's a Vedic culture, our culture is a different culture.
Then Rishi, I think he's also asking, is the same principle apply for a son, that the son is also the property of his parents?
Well, no one's the property of anyone, because we don't own anything in this world. So when you use this terminology, property, it just means that they're responsible. They're the ones who are responsible. They're the ones who know their son. And they also have experience with functioning in the world. So it's their responsibility, their children are their responsibility, especially in making such important phases in life, like occupation, marriage, and things like that, until their children become, you know, themselves experienced. But then even then, you know, parents are always the generation ahead in terms of experience. So when you use words like property, then, you know, use it in the overall context, since nirmama moha, nothing's mine. So a Krishna conscious person doesn't think anyone or anything is his property.
Because I guess the defining principle is this, you mentioned about trust, that there is that trust that the parent is, has your best interest at heart and knows that has the trust that you're going to put you in a situation that will be the best thing for you and the safest place for you.
Yeah.
Since right now you have, you know, a situation in communities that have this arranged marriage situation. You've got all these honor killings going on because the child won't succumb to the parents' wishes, so then they think, well, to kill them is better than to have them dishonor the family. So
yeah.
There's obviously a huge breakdown in trust there, but the key principle, what you're saying, is that trust is...
Yeah, but we're not talking about parents and children. We're talking about a culture.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what we're talking, it's not an issue of parents having rights over their children and determining that their children should get married. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a culture, and a culture which is based on Krishna consciousness and people who know that they're not this body. When all of these people with all of their honor killings and, you know, they're not willing to let children intermarry, or even in terms of the lifestyles and the consciousness that they have, has got nothing to do with spiritual life. It's narrow-minded, it's tamasic, it's bodily based, it's cultish. So just because they happen to be doing the same thing, but that's got nothing to do with what we're talking about. We're talking about a practice in a completely different culture. This other thing, and particularly that goes on there in England a lot, is a horrible. It's got we have nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it because it's not spiritual. And therefore, it's wrong. If you're not spiritual, you can't guide anyone. So then parents can't guide anybody. That's why we don't listen to their parents when they tell us not to join the Hare Krishnas. Because unfortunately, they don't have the right perspective. So the issue isn't about parents and children. The issue is really about how people are living and what their consciousness is. And if the Krishna consciousness is absent, then you get all kinds of problems. And then you get all kinds of things. All of these things come out. Well, the parents don't kill their children.
Thank you so much. Devarishi also thanks you and says it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, everything. The only problem is that Vedic culture, and to establish that type of culture, you can't do the externals, you have to do the basic, the internal, and that's real Krishna consciousness. And when Krishna consciousness is absent, then you can't construct Vedic culture just by imitating the external activities. And that's sort of what, Hinduism has become. It's all the externals of Vedic culture minus the Krishna consciousness. It's like, what the 80,000 people, 99% of them who come, he says, come to the temple and worship Krishna for Janmashtami, but don't you become a serious devotee of Krishna. In other words, do the externals, but just don't get too serious about what it's all about. And if you become a devotee of Krishna, then under no means should you even think about leaving university or giving up your career. So, and it's very difficult in that sense when we're talking, and these things are there. You're talking about a culture even 500 years ago in India. That was Sakshi Gopal's story. And people were so different 100 years ago. People were so different 20 years, 30 years ago. Before outsourcing and computer technology made India insane, things were really, really different. But now, India, Hinduism, Vedic culture, it's all gone. It's all really lost its soul. And therefore, the only way to actually get people to reestablish their soul is they chant Hare Krishna. So yes, if father wants to have proprietary rights over his daughter, then he should be chanting 16 rounds a day. Following regulative principles. If he's just some kind of drunkard materialist, then he's got nothing to say over anyone.